This message, titled The Pharisee and the Tax Collector, from Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com.
Well, brothers and sisters, there was a 16th century English reformer, a man by the name of John Bradford. I don't know this morning if you're familiar with John Bradford, if you're familiar with his biography at all, but you have likely heard a term, a turn of phrase that is actually attributed to him. Very briefly, John Bradford lived, as I said, in the early 16th century. He was a man who was executed, burned at the stake by Mary Tudor, who was also known as Bloody Mary, for the amount of people that she executed during her wicked reign. And John Bradford was executed for the very things that we as a congregation believe and profess and probably take for granted on a daily basis. A reminder to us that the faith once and for all delivered to the saints really comes to us in many ways on a long river of blood. And when John Bradford was being executed, there was a younger man tied to the stake with him. And it's one of my favorite accounts of the martyrs. John Bradford turned to him and said, "Young man, be of good courage. Tonight we will feast with the Lamb." Well, John Bradford was a man who was known for tremendous godliness, a very humble spirit, a man with a tender conscience, well acquainted with his own sins. And the turn of phrase that is attributed to him that many of us have probably heard a variant of at one time or another in our lives happened one day when John Bradford was walking down the street, and he saw there on the other side of the street a group of men who were headed for execution. Some of society's most rebellious and rough and tough. And John Bradford declared on that day to a companion who was with him these words, "But for the grace of God, there goes John Bradford." And he didn't say those words in a note of condescension. He didn't say them in a note of despising those prisoners, but a true and a deep and a lasting awareness of the reality of his own sin. That if the sovereign and free grace of God had not come and plucked him out of his sin and misery, John Bradford was deeply impressed with the truth that he would be as a condemned man heading to his execution. And that expression, "but for the grace of God, there go I," is an expression that has often been repeated. And it is one that is helpful as each of us, you and I together, fight against the tremendous pressure of what we might call self-righteousness. Self-righteousness, to be right in your own eyes, is a terrible sin. And as I've said, it exerts a tremendous pressure against all of our hearts. And as we think about that this morning, we come in Luke chapter 18 to a very fitting parable. It is a parable that is told to a specific group of people. We see that in the 9th verse. He, that is Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. To put that perhaps in our own contemporary terms, this group of people that Jesus now turns to address, these people whom Luke tells us they trusted in themselves, that they themselves were righteous. Simply put, what that means is these people believed, as they turned their eyes inward, as they examined their lives, that there was enough good in them, there was enough righteousness in them, that they could get a passing grade before God. They may not be passing with flying colors, but they certainly were not failing God's standard. And they were trusting in themselves that they were righteous, that they were right, that they had done enough in order to stand right in the presence of God. And when we understand that this is the group of people whom Jesus is addressing, in a very real sense, brothers and sisters, we need to remember that this defines most people. Most people in the world around us, and let's be a little more personal, most of our own hearts, at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, we are convinced that we are righteous enough. That I'm not like those unrighteous people over there, but I'm better than they are. And it's very easy to yield to the temptation of self-righteousness. And Luke wants us to know, here's the people whom Jesus is now about to tell this parable to. He speaks to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Please know this morning. That whenever we think righteously of ourselves, the twin error, the twin sin is to despise other people. When we think that we are good, when we think that we are righteous, when we think that we can find in ourselves a passing grade, we automatically despise other people. And so I want you to understand as we come to this parable this morning, this is not a parable for everyone else. This is not a parable for my unbelieving neighbor. I mean, it is a parable that is suited for them. They too need to hear these words. But brothers and sisters, do not exclude yourself this morning from these people whom Jesus is addressing. You know, in many ways, as we look at this group of people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt, this is a group of people, can I put it this way this morning, who are too good to be saved. They're too good to be saved. In their own minds, they are too good to be saved. We're reminded that the gospel message comes with many challenges. Unbelievers and atheists pose a challenge to the Christian gospel. Wicked and rebellious, outright rebellious people present a challenge to the gospel, but here is one of the greatest challenges to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Men, women, young, old, adults, and children who think themselves too good to be saved. And Jesus comes with this parable to graphically illustrate his point. It's the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And you'll note in the way in which this parable unfolds that there's several similarities between the Pharisee and the tax collector. They're both men. That's what we read in this parable. There were two men. And both of these men went up to the temple. They both went up to the temple to pray. Their prayers don't have a lot in common. The only word that their prayer has in common is the three-letter word, God. But they both go to the temple. They both intend to pray to God, to worship him. And both of them return home at the end of this parable. Those are the similarities. But it is also where the similarities end. And I want you to see this morning that this parable is not about their similarities, but it is a parable about the tremendous differences between these two men. And what I hope to do with the strength of the Spirit this morning is to preach to you the three great differences between this Pharisee and the tax collector. I want you to notice this morning the first difference. The first difference is this: it is their profession. Both of these men are, in one sense of the word, they're professionals, aren't they? Jesus tells us there in the 10th verse, two men went up into the temple to pray. Jesus doesn't name them. The only way in which he distinguishes them is by what they do. You might say by their trade, by their earthly vocation. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. And as Jesus begins this parable and presents these two men, in a very real sense, brothers and sisters, Jesus could not have picked two more different men to put before us in this parable. I racked my brain this week to try to think in modern terms of how different these two men would be. And perhaps the best analogy that I could come up with is imagine that this parable were about a medical missionary doctor who gave his life to third world countries to go and to heal those who had no medical care, compared to a serial killer who lived to take the life of other people. They are worlds apart. There is no similarities between those two men. And in much the same way, Jesus is presenting in this parable two men with this marked difference. One is a Pharisee, the other is a tax collector. They could not be more opposite to one another. And why is that? Well, on the one hand, we have the Pharisee. And what is a Pharisee? We've been looking at the life and the ministry of Jesus. If you're familiar with the Gospels, you know that the Pharisees come up again and again and again. Time and again in the Gospels, the Pharisees are really set forth as the primary antagonists to Jesus. And because we're familiar with the scriptures and because we're familiar with the life and the ministry of Jesus, it is very easy for us to form a almost instantaneous judgment on who the Pharisees were. But I want you to know this morning that in this day and age and in this culture, the Pharisees were men who by the common people were often held in very high regard. The Pharisees were people who, even among common folk, were commended again and again. Who were the Pharisees? Well, one ancient historian gave a very simple definition. He said the Pharisees, this is not a biblical historian, but he said the Pharisees, he says they were a group of Jews who considered themselves the godliest of the nation, and who were the most rigorous followers of the law of God. They were a group of Jews who were the most rigorous followers of the law of God. And again, we need to understand this from the perspective of when Jesus is telling this parable. It is so easy to hear here, well, there's a Pharisee that goes to the temple, and our lips almost curl with disgust. Oh, I know the Pharisees. They're hypocrites. They're rotten men. They are wicked men. And true as that is, nevertheless, there was, in one sense, by outward appearances, no person in the collective community who were as upstanding as the Pharisees. They were exemplary men. They were exemplary men. The word Pharisee literally meant holy one. It meant one who was separated. They were defined by a tremendous love, you might say, again, by outward appearances, defined by a tremendous love for the law of God. They saw in the law of God the wisdom of God. They were also, the Pharisees were, can I put it this way this morning, they were very orthodox in their theology. They were, if we can think of it in these terms, they were the conservatives of their day. They believed in the wisdom of God's law. They believed in the sovereignty of God. They believed in human responsibility. They believed in the resurrection of the dead. They believed in angels and demons. They believed in the life to come. And they scrupulously kept the law of God. They were so concerned about being obedient to God that they formed their own traditions. And it's easy, again, for us to point the finger at them until we understand that the reason they followed these traditions, it was, in one sense, very good intentioned, because they didn't want to break the law of God. That's who the Pharisees were. What else do we know about Pharisees? Perhaps, brothers and sisters, you've heard that little anecdote. How do you know when somebody's training for a marathon? And the answer is, don't worry, they'll tell you. People who train for marathons love to talk about training for marathons. And in a very similar way, the Pharisees loved to talk about being Pharisees. And we see that even here, don't we, in the very words of this unnamed Pharisee. In verse 11, the Pharisee standing by himself prayed thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. And then in verse 12, look, I fast twice a week. The Pharisees were known to be men who fasted twice a week. If you remember the law of Moses, the Old Testament, only required the Jews to fast once a year. According to the book of Leviticus, they were only to fast, the obligatory fast was on the Day of Atonement. But here's the Pharisee, I fast twice a week. Happened to be Monday and Thursdays. And not only did he fast twice a week, but we read in verse 12, I fast twice a week, I give tithe of all that I get. Of all that I get. Again, the law of Moses required a tithe, but it did not require a tithe of all that one had. It required the tithe of the firstling of the flock, of grain, of wine, and of oil. But the Pharisee is one who tithed everything. In Matthew chapter 23, Jesus says the Pharisees tithe out of their spice cupboard. They weigh their spices on a balance and they give one-tenth to God. You see, not only was the Pharisee in many ways an example to other people, but a Pharisee was given to extraordinary devotion, and we need to keep that in mind as we understand the force of this parable. By all outward appearances, the Pharisee is one of the most exemplary people you can imagine. He has crossed all his T's. He has dotted all of his I's. He speaks the talk. He knows how to talk the talk. He knows how to look like one who is holy by all accounts and for all purposes. By all outward appearances, here is the Pharisee. But here's the difference. We not only have a Pharisee, we have this man identified by the profession. What is he? He is a tax collector. And again, if you're familiar with the Gospels, tax collectors often come up in the ministry of Jesus. Jesus was one who frequently ate with tax collectors, and it was all kinds of scandal to people. How could Jesus eat with a tax collector? Why is that? Well, in many ways, it's very hard to think this morning of an example of a person, of a profession, you might say, that was hated more than the tax collector. Not to get into all the socio-political environment and background, but in the Roman Empire, you'll remember that in the days in which the New Testament was written, in the days of Jesus' earthly ministry, the Roman Empire was the superpower of the world. And the Roman Empire exacted taxes upon the people of Israel. They came in and they imposed these taxes on them. And while the Roman Empire collected many of their taxes themselves, they also hired Jews, men who would be tax collectors. They're also in the Gospels known as publicans, because they publicly received the taxes of the people. These were Jewish people who were hired, really contracted by the Roman Empire to gather taxes. And in many ways, it was impossible to be a tax collector and a good Israelite at the same time. Not in many ways it was. It was impossible to be a good Jew and to be a tax collector, because in the collection of taxes, you could not ultimately keep the law of God. Because as these tax collectors went and collected money from their countrymen, they did so by extortion. They did so by force and by threats. The only money that these tax collectors made and were able to pocket was the money that they took on top of the taxes that were owed to the Roman Empire. And so they'd fudge the numbers. You owe this in taxes, but oh, you're actually going to pay me this much. And they'd threaten people. They'd extort the money. They would pocket the extra. They'd give the rest to the Roman Empire. And tax collectors were absolutely hated by the people. They were men who really were the very epitome of selfishness and greed. We saw last week, didn't we, in the parable of Jesus, that you cannot serve God and money at the same time. It's impossible. And the tax collectors were men who chose not to serve God, but to serve gold and to serve silver. And they were greedy, and they were extortioners, and they were selfish. They were regarded in this day and age as thieves. Somebody once said an honest tax collector was a starving tax collector. And they were despised by all the people. They were often lumped together with thieves, with murderers, and with prostitutes. They disgraced their families. They were expelled from the worship of the synagogue. Anything that they touched, the people believed was unclean, and they were held accountable. They were believed to be traitors. And so you see, this is the big difference. This parable, Jesus is distinguishing between the Pharisee, who on the one hand, by all outward appearances, is an exemplary person. And on the other hand, you have a tax collector, who is more hated and despised than any other man in that culture. That's the first difference, this difference of profession. But I want you to notice a second difference this morning, a second difference, and that is their prayer. We read in verse 10, two men went up into the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other was a tax collector. Both of these men went to the temple to pray. Now, in that day and age, perhaps you know this, the temple had two daily services. There was a morning sacrifice and there was an evening sacrifice. And during those sacrifices was the time when the people could come and they could gather in the temple and they could offer their prayers. And Luke doesn't tell us that that's exactly the time of day in which they go, but it is very likely that this Pharisee and this tax collector, as the sacrifice is being offered, are going to the temple to offer their prayers as they were supposed to do. And they go to the temple in order to worship God, to pray to him. And interestingly, we're told in this parable, aren't we? We are told the content of their prayers. Can I admit this morning that you can tell a lot about somebody by the way they pray? I think it was Robert Murray McShane, that Scottish preacher, who said, "A man is nothing more than what he is on his knees before God. What a man is in prayer, that he is nothing more and nothing less." Our prayers can tell people a lot about who we are and what we value and what we think of ourselves. And of course, Jesus teaches us, doesn't he, in Luke chapter 6, verse 45, that it is out of the overflow of the heart that the mouth speaks. You want to know what's in someone's heart? Listen to the words they speak. You want to know what's in somebody's heart? Listen to the way that they pray. And again, Jesus draws this tremendous difference between the prayer of the Pharisee and the prayer of the tax collector. Look at the prayer of the Pharisee. What does a man like that have to pray about? A man who's dotted all his I's, a man who's crossed all his T's, a man who by outward appearances is the holiest person you would ever meet, one of the most commendable people you could possibly think of. What does a man like that have to pray about? Well, Jesus tells us in verse 11, the Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus: "God, I thank you that I am not like other men." And I want you to pause there for a moment, because it's so easy to miss the subtlety of this man's prayer. What do I mean by that? Look how this man addresses God. "God, I thank you." The Pharisee does not stand there in the temple and pray, "Good for me, myself, and I." The Pharisee does not stand in the temple and say, "Good for me, look at what a wonderful man I have made myself." The Pharisee says, "God, I thank you." And there's a subtlety there that cannot be missed. To miss this subtlety is to miss the force and the weight of this parable altogether. This Pharisee stands there and he says, God, I thank you. It is not, I thank myself and I thank my own strength and I thank my own innovativeness and I think of my skills and my talents and my wisdom. But he says, God, I thank you. And yet this man immediately begins to betray himself. He immediately begins to betray himself. Why is that? God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers. You know, in one sense, we can almost understand that prayer, can't we? The Psalms actually almost encourage us to sing in similar ways. Psalm 26, the psalmist says, I hate all evildoers. I want to stay away from unjust men. I don't want to go near them. And there's almost one sense, and it's the nuance, and it's all the subtlety of this parable. Should we be thankful that we're not adulterers? Yeah. Should we be thankful that we're not extortioners? Yeah, we probably should be. But you see, this man begins to expose himself in the most nuanced of ways. God, I thank you that I'm not like these other men. I'm not like extortioners. I'm not like the unjust. I'm not like adulterers. And then, or even like this tax collector. And what is he doing in that moment? Let's look at that tax collector who's in the temple with him. You can almost begin to hear the note of self-righteousness. I'm so glad I'm not like him. He's got a long list of sins. He's greedy. He's a traitor. He's unclean. He's a disgrace. He's selfish. He's an extortioner. And the Pharisee saying, I'm really, really glad. God, thank you that I don't have such a long list of sins. Because I'm a Pharisee. And I'm set apart. And where this man has a long list of sins, I have a long resume of doing well because I fast twice a week and I tithe out of all that I get. Thank you, God, that I'm not like this tax collector. And we see here in, again, brothers and sisters, the most subtle of ways. We see here the tremendous danger of self-deception. Here's an axiomatic truth that is true of every single one of us, young and old, men and women. Brothers and sisters, on the whole, all of us assume far better of ourselves than we should. All of us assume far better of ourselves than we should. You want proof of that? How do you respond when somebody tells you you've done something wrong? How do you respond when your husband or wife or friend says, guess what, you've sinned? If your knee-jerk reaction is to defend yourself, is to argue it, is to get angry, why? Because you assume better than yourself. I think it was Charles Spurgeon who said, when a man comes to you and points out your sin to you, don't get angry with him, thank him. And then tell him, friend, you don't know the half of it. We all assume far better of ourselves than we should. And this Pharisee is standing there, deceived, self-righteous, despising this tax collector. I am so glad, God, that I don't have the long list of sins that he has. But then notice the prayer of the tax collector. What does a man like that have to pray about? in verse 13, but the tax collector, standing far off. It's interesting, isn't it? Luke notes, Jesus notes the place where both these men stand. The Pharisee stands by himself. He can't get near the extortioners and the unjust, and he certainly can't get near the tax collector. But the tax collector, standing far off, not even daring to approach the altar where the sacrifice is, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." Can't even bring himself to raise his eyes to heaven, where God is seated in his righteousness. And all he can do is beat his breast. It probably seems a little weird to us. Have you ever seen somebody beat their breast in prayer? You know, we can almost relate to that, can't we? Have you ever just been so angry in a moment, you just kind of choke the air in front of you? "I'm just so angry right now." That's what this tax collector is like. But he's not angry. He is full of grief and he is full of sorrow for his sins. And he just beats his chest. "God, be merciful to me. Be merciful to me." And what's so fascinating, again, part of the nuance of this parable is the word that the tax collector uses. "God, be merciful to me." The word that he uses there for merciful is not the common word in the Bible that we get the word mercy from. It is a word that is only used twice in the New Testament, here and in Hebrews chapter 2. And the word quite literally means this. The word that he uses is this: "God, make propitiation for me." Now that's a big word, propitiation. You know, as Christians, we have a Christian vocabulary, don't we? There are some words that our theology teaches us. You think of the word Trinity. The word Trinity is not in the Bible, and yet it behooves all of us to have a definition for what we mean by Trinity, one God in three persons. The word incarnation is a theological word. It's not a word that you find in the Bible. Propitiation is not merely a theological word. It is a biblical word. It is a word that is used multiple times in the scriptures to portray to us, to give us an understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so, brothers and sisters, I mean that we need a biblical vocabulary. We need to understand the terms by which God has made his gospel grace known, and propitiation is one of them. And this tax collector is beating his chest, and he is saying, "God, make propitiation for me." And what does that mean? Propitiation very simply means this. It means to appease. When you appease somebody, you're making satisfaction for them, aren't you? When you appease somebody, you're trying to give them something to turn them. It's the word that means quite literally to make atonement for. And what is so fascinating is that this tax collector is there, isn't he? He's in the temple. And he's most likely in the temple during what? During the sacrifice. When the lamb has been slain, when the lamb has been flayed, when his blood has been spilled out, and the lamb has been placed on the altar, and it has been set on fire to be a burnt offering to God. It is a picture and an illustration of the redemptive work of Jesus Christ. And this tax collector sees the lamb on the altar, and he says, "God, make atonement for me. Find a way to be propitiated. Find a way to be reconciled to me." That's what this man is praying for. That's what he's pleading for. He is pleading for Jesus Christ. "Find a way, God, to be reconciled to me." As the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews 2, verse 17, that Christ has become like us to make a propitiation for the sins of the people. In Romans chapter 3, verse 23, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by His grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Jesus Christ, whom God has put forward to be a propitiation by blood to be received by faith. That's what this man is praying. Make atonement for me. He beats his chest, verse 13, the tax collector standing far off would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast saying, God, be merciful to me. And you'll notice most of your translations say, be merciful to me, a sinner. It's not the best translation of what's actually there. I don't do this often, but I think there's an important point here. What this man actually says is, God, be merciful to me, the sinner, not a sinner, right? As this man stands before the altar, as he can't even bring his eyes to be raised to heaven, as he beats his chest and prays for atonement, he's not saying, oh, be merciful to me, a sinner among sinners. He's saying, be merciful to me, the sinner. As if in that moment, he is the only person standing there before the bar of God's justice. And you know, there's something profound in that, isn't there? There's something profound, and what is so profound about that, brothers and sisters, is simply this, that when it comes to standing before the justice of God, it is not me and everyone else. Each of us stands before God for ourselves. Our parents can't stand there with us. Our pastor can't stand there with us. Elders can't stand there with us. Our boyfriends, our girlfriends, our family, our friends cannot stand there. It is me, myself, and I before the justice of a holy God. And He gets it. Make atonement for me, He says. Make atonement for me, the sinner. Make atonement for me, the sinner. And you know, as you hear that glorious prayer of faith, how much it casts us back to truly hate what the Pharisee is saying. Here is a tax collector who probably for the first time in his life is repenting of sin. And what are the angels in heaven doing? Jesus tells us that when one person repents, the angels in heaven rejoice. Here's a man whose heart is broken, pleading for atonement, and the Pharisee is sitting there, I'm really glad I'm not him. Their prayers could not be more different. But I want you to notice the third difference this morning. Very briefly, the third difference, not only is there a difference in their profession, not only is there a difference in their prayer, but there is a difference in their pronouncement. And here's what I mean. Jesus comes here then in this parable, doesn't he? In verse 14, I tell you, this man, that is the tax collector, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. This man went down to his house justified rather than the other. And that's the third difference. As they return home, Jesus pronounces the tax collector is justified, whereas the Pharisee is not. Now, what does that mean? Well, there in verse 14, the tax collector, and now he's put forth, right? The Pharisee has had all the priority in this parable. We hear first about the Pharisee until we come to verse 14, then the order is reversed. And Jesus says, I want you to know this about the tax collector. I'm going to deal with the Pharisee in a minute, it's as if he's saying, but I want you to know this tax collector went down to his house justified. And what does Jesus mean? Brothers and sisters, I'm going to be very blunt. Justification is one of the Bible's most important teachings. If you have been a Christian for a year or 5 years or a decade or 50 years and you don't know what justification is, friends, you need to go back to the Bible and understand this. What does it mean to be justified? To be justified very simply means to be declared just, to be declared as one who is in the right. And that is a fascinating thing for Jesus to say, because the way this tax collector has lived all his life, he is anything but right. He is anything but just. He is a man who is defined and identified by the fact that he is unjust. But Jesus says he goes home justified. He goes home as one who is declared righteous, as one who is declared just, as one who by faith alone in Christ alone has had his sins forgiven. We sang that in the 32nd Psalm. Blessed is the man whose sins are not counted as his own. And Jesus is saying this tax collector has gone home and he no longer bears the guilt of his sin. He is counted, he is reckoned as righteous in the sight of God. And why? Not because of anything he can stand upon, but because God in Christ has made atonement in Jesus. So that God can be merciful, he can be the just and the justifier, as Paul says, of the one who has faith in him. This man has nothing to stand upon. He has nothing to speak for him. He has no evidence to claim for himself. He can only plead the mercy and the forgiveness and the pardon of God. And Jesus says he goes home justified. Singing, even as we sang in the 32nd Psalm, the songs of our release. But then what does Jesus say? I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. Friends, we need to feel the weight of that. The tax collector went to his house justified. The Pharisee did not. And what does that mean? It simply means this: that Pharisee is still in his sins. That Pharisee is one who is not justified in the sight of God. He is not right in the sight of God. He is not forgiven. He is not pardoned. But he bears the weight of his own sin. And the scriptures tell us very clearly, Romans chapter 1, verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed against all unrighteousness. This is a man in his sin who remains under the infinite wrath of God. And there's a weight to that. This Pharisee came to the temple to worship God. He came and he prayed. He saw the sacrifice being offered on the altar, and he returned home no better for it. Still under the weight of his sin, because he could not, he would not humble himself in the sight of God, but he exalted himself in the sight of God, trusting to the catalog of his virtues and of his works and of his goodness, and he goes home unjustified. Friends, I have spent the good majority of this sermon describing to you this parable. Very little application. But the application is crystal clear. Jesus himself says, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted." Friends, this is why Jesus tells us that the kingdom is found by those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, who have a right estimation of themselves and of their sins, who do not stand to make a defense or an argument with God, but like the tax collector, beat their breast and say, "God, find a way to make atonement for me, the sinner? And the question is so simple. Which are you? Are you that Pharisee who's trusting in themselves that they were righteous and treating everyone else with contempt? Or are you the humble tax collector, pleading for nothing but the mercy of God as it's revealed in Jesus Christ? Let's pray.